Hey guys, it's Thanos Develis here at HALC headquarters for another episode of the Greek Current podcast. And joining me today is Georgia Logothetis.
Hi, everybody.
And it's a pleasure to welcome Professor George Dimakopoulos to our podcast for the first time as well. George is the Father John Mayendorf and Patterson Family Chair of Orthodox Christian Studies and the co-director of the Orthodox Christian Studies Center at Fordham University. He's a specialist in the history of Christianity and will share his insight on a story that we've been following very closely here, and namely that's the tension between the Ecumenical Patriarchate and Russia that seems to have brought the Patriarch to the center of a geopolitical battle between Russia and the West in Ukraine. So, George, thank you so much for joining us and welcome.
It's my pleasure. Thank you for having me.
I want to kick off and dive in to start our discussion with the recent announcement from Moscow to cut ties with the Ecumenical Patriarchate. This has been described as a step down the road toward one of the most serious schisms in Christianity for centuries. Can you walk us through, you know, what happened and why?
Yes. So,
and if you agree that it is one of the most serious schisms in Christianity.
Well, it is, although at this point, we're nowhere near there. Right. So I'd like to be clear about that. So we have to, let me back up, because there are really three different issues at play that are interconnected, but they're actually separate questions. So the first question is, what do we do about the fact that there are three different groups in the Ukraine that claim to be the rightful or canonical Orthodox Church in the Ukraine? How do we resolve that question? That's one issue. The second issue, which is not unrelated to it, is the question of how do the Christians in Ukraine go about obtaining autocephaly, which means self-governance or independence, if that's what they want? Who gets to decide if that's the case? And as both of those two questions have really come to the fore in the last couple months, the Ecumenical Patriarch has staked out a position on both issues that the Patriarch of Moscow very much resents on both issues. And as a consequence of that, Moscow has now gone and done something which is not unrelated, but very, very different in the sense that it has broken sacramental communion with the Ecumenical Patriarchate. So those are three different things that all deserve attention, and they're interrelated, but they really are different questions. So I wanted to start with that and give you the chance to follow up, or I can go back and explain
for
the
sure.
history.
I actually do have a follow-up. I know you had a great thread on Twitter where you stated that, you know, the issue of granting autocephaly is maybe the single greatest ecclesiastical challenge that we face now. So can you walk us through, like, what's the history behind that? What does it mean for a church to be autocephalous? And I know that's one of these three issues that obviously, and it's the big issue.
Right. Okay. So we have to understand the history of autocephaly through the lens of the consequences of the Roman Emperor Constantine converting to Christianity. When the Roman Emperor Saint Constantine, converted to Christianity in the early 4th century and turned the, began a process that made Christianity the official religion of the Roman Empire, it initiated a series of institutional transformations for the church in which the administration of the church in many ways came to mirror precisely the administrative structures of the Roman Empire. So in ways that ordinary Christians simply don't realize or appreciate. So for example, the very idea of dividing the geography of the Christian world into a diocese or into a metropolis or even into a patriarchate, which is the current model in the Orthodox world and has been for a long time, that is really a one-to-one mirroring of how the Roman Empire divided its world. for the purposes of raising taxes, moving armies, and just sort of orchestrating a centralized governmental system.
The general administration of the empire.
Precisely, across a lot of geographic and cultural spaces. And so the church literally just mapped it. If the Roman Empire decided to divide a province in the middle of Asia Minor, then the church had to immediately reciprocate and divide its diocese into two and elect a second bishop, right? So it really is a one-to-one system. So since the church has been doing this since the 16th century, or for the last 1600 years, rather, since the 4th century, mm-hmm. it has always been the case that the church governance mirrors geopolitical realities. Okay, so tuck that away for a second. When the Byzantine Empire fell apart because of the Ottomans and what have you, the geopolitical realities of the Orthodox world were completely transformed. And on the other side of that, when the Ottoman Empire fell apart and you got the emergence of nation states in Eastern Europe in traditionally Orthodox lands, they took the concept of autocephaly, or a self-governing jurisdiction, that had originally existed within the complex of the Roman Empire, but then mapped that notion of independence onto the concept of the nation state. So in the Roman world, you had five or six or seven, depending on when you're talking about, five or six or seven different autocephalous churches, but they were all part of one empire. In the post-Ottoman period, you got an explosion of new autocephalous or independent churches, but they mirrored the kind of nation state model, or largely mirrored it, at least for all the new ones. So you've got
Greece, Serbia, Bulgaria,
Albania, the Czech lands, Estonia, Finland, on and on and on. Okay. Mm-hmm. And with that kind of in the backdrop, you have to understand that for at least a century, there have been Christians in Ukraine who have been agitating for their own autocephalous or self-governing church, for a lot of different reasons. Has to do with the history of their relationship to Russia. It has to do with their sense of national identity and so forth. Okay. And so in the modern world, we have a situation where we still have this legacy of autocephalous churches. But now, more than ever, they are tied to notions of ethnic or national identity in a way that they really weren't for more than 1,000 years.
I want to jump in real quick because you brought up a great point about how kind of the structure of the church and the interdynamics of the church relates to geopolitical realities. And you mentioned that in Ukraine, it's been, you know, over a century that the Christians have been kind of trying for this. Why is this happening now? In other words, what precipitated it happening? Why isn't this something, obviously, that the Ecumenical Patriarchate did a while back, or why is this something that they didn't hold for the future? What changed in that geopolitical dynamic that precipitated this event?
Yeah, so the shortest answer to that, although this also is a complex answer, but the shortest answer to that is the Russian annexation of Crimea two or three years ago. It, for an increasing number of Christians in the Ukraine, it became pastorally inconceivable that the Moscow Patriarchate could provide the kind of pastoral care that is necessary in Ukraine when you have really a kind of proxy war going on in eastern Ukraine. So that inaugurated a series of geopolitical steps that brought this more to the fore. Yeah,
so it's much more than another arcane theological dispute, some call it, but something with profound political consequences that we'll see play out.
That's right. And to be absolutely clear, this is not a theological debate. It is a jurisdictional debate, which has, you know, resonances in a kind of theological category known as ecclesiology. Mm-hmm. But this is not a debate about belief. Nobody disagrees about their concept of the Trinity or the Incarnation or the significance of the birth, death, resurrection of Jesus. This is not theology. This is an administrative and pastoral issue. And so so you had a couple of different things going on. So you have former Soviet you have to understand that many of the actors here are former Soviets, right, whether in Ukraine or in Russia. And they think about geopolitics and the role of religion in the very same in similar ways, even though they have different objectives. Right. So the politicians in Ukraine really stepped up their pressure on the Ecumenical Patriarch to get involved after the Russian annexation of Crimea. So you have that on the one hand. You also have the efforts by the Moscow Patriarchate to torpedo the Council in Crete that was supposed to be this big gathering of all of the autocephalous churches in 2016. And, you know, it's no matter what they might say, everybody who follows this knows very well that they did everything they could to try to prevent that council from happening. And so to answer the question, why now? It's the confluence of those things. It's the kind of bad faith of the Moscow Patriarchate vis-a-vis the Council of Crete. It's the Russian political and military incursions into eastern Ukraine. It is political actors in Ukraine seizing the opportunity to try to aid their own nationalist agenda by employing the concept of an independent Ukrainian church, and so forth. So you have all of these different things going on at the same time.
One of the articles mentioned that this exertion of power by the Ecumenical Patriarch is very, very rare. In other words, he's dedicated his tenure to kind of being a symbolic or representative leader. And this is actually like an exertion of power based on documents that people didn't kind of expect. Can you tell us a little bit about that? And what do you think it does to the reputation of the Ecumenical Patriarch?
Yeah. So we're treading again onto difficult areas, right? So there is absolutely no question that the Ecumenical Patriarch is perceived to be the phrase some people sometimes use is the first among equals, right? Mm-hmm. So among the 14 jurisdictions, there nobody disputes in terms of canon law or tradition that the Ecumenical Patriarch gets the first seat, so to speak. Nobody disputes that. There are some kind of ongoing debates about just what level of authority does that position entail. And an honest reading of history will say that there is no single set answer to that question because it has been exercised in different ways over the centuries. This particular patriarch has typically refrained from taking a heavy hand in situations. He did occasionally when he was first in his role. He did something actually quite similar with the case of the Estonians. I believe the year was 1996 when the Soviet Union broke apart. The Christians in Estonia sought their own autocephalous church, and it was recognized by the Ecumenical Patriarch. He stepped into a void and asserted it. In a way that the Moscow Patriarchate at the time objected to very strenuously, but ultimately conceded to. Things have changed quite a bit in 20 years. The Moscow Patriarchate has grown far more internally powerful in Russia and has been far more closely tied to the state, even if, and this is the case, we don't see this in the West, even if it is actually true that the actual church attendance in Russia is only around 1%. Only about 1%, maybe 2% of the population in Russia actually attends church on a weekend. So we have this notion that the church is very, very powerful. It is certainly more powerful than it once was, but it does not dominate the landscape of Russia like we in the West might assume.
That's an actually very interesting point because my next question was going to touch on those exact that exact issue where the Kremlin and the patriarch in Moscow have such close ties. what's that political fallout of this decision for a man like President Vladimir Putin, who kind of has built up national support by framing himself as this political defender of Christians? And I know there was a Bloomberg article out there that even likened him kind of to Henry VIII potentially driving the Orthodox Church now in Russia into isolation with the decision.
So there are a few things here that need to be said. The first is, again, our understanding in the West is often incomplete. The Patriarch Kirill and Vladimir Putin do have a very strong working relationship, but it should be emphasized that they are not always on the same page in a way that we assume that they are. There is that. We also need to understand that the church in Russia itself is far more diverse than we appreciate. Not everyone approves of the path that either Putin or Kirill is taking, and there are large bodies of dissent. Some more fundamentalist or super nationalist, and some more progressive. So you really do have a spectrum there that we don't fully appreciate in the West. That said, when communism fell apart in Russia and the church began to reemerge and people were grasping for what does it mean to be a Russian in the wake of this, 70, 80 years of the Bolsheviks, the church emerged and Slavic Christianity emerged as that one kind of civilizational piece that defined what it meant to be a Russian. It was historic, and it differentiated the Russians from the rest of the world, right? A kind of proud national identity rooted in a history of Slavic Christianity, which differentiated it from the West, it differentiated it from the Far East, so forth and so on. And Patriarch Kirill was instrumental in helping to frame that identity construction, and it has been something that Vladimir Putin has embraced in his effort to speak about a kind of Russian identity that extends beyond the borders of the Russian state. So in Putin's vision, these ideas are what bind the peoples of Ukraine and Belarus to Russia, this concept of a greater Christian Russia and so forth. So all of this is, in a sense, a long way of saying the possibility of Ukrainian independence from the Russian church really undermines that vision and constructed identity. And so it's not surprising that the Russian church and Vladimir Putin would be concerned about this kind of move, and so they're going to retaliate in ways that they think that they can. The breaking of communion, to kind of jump to the other issue that I identified from the outset, the breaking of communion is really the nuclear option. And I think they went that route because they really didn't have many other options left, or at least they felt like they didn't have many other options left.
So let's jump in a time machine, go forward about 6 months. What's your prediction about how everything shakes out? And I'm specifically interested in the relations between the Russian Orthodox Church and the Ecumenical Patriarchate.
Yeah, I think the BBC had an explainer about like what the five things to know about this whole issue today. And they mentioned the possibility, going off George's question, about tensions between the Moscow and the Fanar spreading to Eastern Europe, to the Balkans, to the other autocephalous churches, and forcing them kind of to choose sides. Do you think that's something that we should expect, or will it spill over into unorthodox relations in the United States? Because most of us here belong in some way, I mean, the Greek Orthodox to the Ecumenical Patriarch, but other groups are, to the Serbian Church or to the Antiochian, Bulgarian.
Yeah. So actually, can we play the time machine game, but back up a week?
Sounds sure. good. Yeah.
All right. So let's back up a week prior to Moscow's breaking communion. Okay. If Moscow had not taken, again, what I call the nuclear option, I think that they would have actually found a number of allies among the other autocephalous leaders, and could have likely persuaded those allies to come out and critique the Ecumenical Patriarch's intervention in Ukraine. Why do I say that? I say that for two reasons. One, because it is an open question, if we're going to be honest, it is an open question as to whether or not the Ecumenical Patriarch has the authority to do this in the way that he's doing it. There are arguments that say yes, there are arguments that say no, there is nothing objectively 100% conclusive one way or the other, okay? So that's one reason the Russians might have found allies. The even bigger reason that the Russians might have found allies is that if you look at churches like the Church of Serbia or the Church of Romania, et cetera, some of these kind of neutral players in the middle, they have their own issues in terms of small communities within their jurisdiction that are seeking their own independence. So for the Serbs, for example, you have the Macedonian question, you have the Montenegrin question, right? You have Christians in those communities that are agitating for their own autocephaly. And in a pre-nuclear option scenario, I can imagine a scenario in which the Moscow Patriarch could have found a ready ally in the Serbian Patriarch or the Romanian Patriarch, etc. Because those, as I say, those churches have their own concerns for just a proliferation of autocephalous churches. But now that the Russians have taken the nuclear option, what they are forcing the other 12 jurisdictions to do is to say whether or not they will join the Russians in breaking communion with the Ecumenical Patriarchate. And I honestly don't see a single one that's going to do it. I can guarantee you that the Russians will do everything they can behind the scenes to try to convince some of these jurisdictions to break communion with Constantinople. But I just don't see a scenario in which they will, at least not as things stand at the moment. If we go out 6 months, if our time machine only goes, 1 week back or 6 months forward, mm-hmm. I don't think anything changes. I don't think this gets resolved in 6 months. I think it becomes a standoff. I think slowly each of the autocephalous leaders will issue statements that say something to the effect of, this is deeply, deeply unfortunate. We all need prayer, but we're not getting involved, right? They're not going to break communion. And we need to also be clear, the Ecumenical Patriarchate has not reciprocated the rejection of communion. So it's the Russians telling Russians that they cannot co-celebrate. The Ecumenical Patriarch has not, and I do not expect him to, reciprocate that excommunication.
So there's an interesting Greece angle as well when we talk about this issue, and that's Mount Athos, where yes. A lot of the Russian ministers and political figures, including Vladimir Putin, have traveled to, and they point to it as, this the holiest place in the Orthodox world, and they try to up their, I guess, their credentials as religious Russians by visiting.
Or benefactors. I saw a report yesterday that Russian businessmen over the last decade have donated over $200 million mm-hmm. to various entities on Mount Athos.
There was a report I was reading that Mount Athos actually is under jurisdiction of the Ecumenical Patriarchate.
Yes.
So what does this mean for Russians that want to travel there?
Yeah, Mount Athos.
And how does Athos play into it? Sorry to cut you off again, but how does it play into the political game? You're seeing the amounts of money that have been invested have been astronomical.
Right. So Mount Athos is really a unique place in a lot of ways. In the world of nation states, the territory of Mount Athos belongs to the nation state of Greece. In jurisdiction, in terms of ecclesiastical jurisdiction, the 20 monasteries of Mount Athos belong to the ecumenical patriarchate. One thing that American Greeks often probably don't realize is that the Church of Greece is an autocephalous mm-hmm. church and is not part of the ecumenical patriarchate. So, you know, if you're born in Patra and move to the United States, you're jumping jurisdictions. So the ecumenical patriarchate has Mount Athos, and also jurisdictionally, it also has a little bit of northeastern Greece as part of its super jurisdiction as well. Okay, so how does this play out? Yes, the Russians have been investing and traveling, and they're probably the largest source of religious pilgrimage to Mount Athos probably comes from Russians, at least in the last decade or so. The spokesperson for the Russian Orthodox Church, Metropolitan Hilarion Alfayev, I saw quoted yesterday at the BBC, and actually I was surprised that he did this, but he said that Russian pilgrims can continue to go to Mount Athos. They can venerate the shrines, the relics, the miracle working icons, and so forth, but they cannot receive the Eucharist on Mount Athos. I was stunned by that. And then the reporter said, "Do you realize that Russian businessmen have given $200 million to Athos over the last decade or so?" And Hilarion's response was, "Yes, I would encourage them to invest in their own Russian monasteries going forward." And then identified some of the monasteries in Ukraine as Russian.
Yeah, it's really fascinating to see mm-hmm. the geopolitical implications all around with a simple decision to, you know, break communion, for example, between two churches. We've got time for one more question, so I'll keep it short. And what does this decision, if anything, what does it mean for believers and the faithful around the world? I know you mentioned that said that they can't take communion.
Focus on the United States.
And I think that'd be an interesting angle for our listeners.
Yeah, here is where it's the most complex. So we have a lot. We don't have a full 14 operational jurisdictions in the United States, but we have a large number. The Greek Orthodox Church of America is by far the largest. There are two groups in the United States that are technically under the Moscow Patriarchate. One are their own Moscow patriarchal communities, and we're talking literally four or five communities. That's it. They have a cathedral in Manhattan. They have a cathedral in D.C., that sort of thing. It's tiny, 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 tiny. And then there's this other long since broken away group called the Russian Orthodox Church outside of Russia. And they were in schism with the rest of the Orthodox world for most of the 20th century. And then at the end of the Cold War, they reunited with Moscow and remained independent and autonomous. So they are a kind of daughter church of the Moscow Patriarchate, but they're run by themselves. So they are among the smallest of the jurisdictions operational in the United States, but they do have a seminary in Jordanville, New York. And they do have, you know, many pious believers and so forth. And so at the moment, members of its community are forbidden from cross-communing with any community tied to the ecumenical patriarchate, which would the largest be the Greek Orthodox Church of America, but also the Carpatho-Russians and the Ukrainian Church of the United States.
Very fascinating conversation. I want to thank you, Professor Dimakopoulos, again for joining us on our podcast. Obviously, this is something that'll be an ongoing mm-hmm. issue that we'll be covering.
We may call on your expertise again as news
exactly.
breaks.
I would be happy to chat again.
Thanks very much. That wraps up our episode of The Greek Current. Thanks for tuning in, and check out the next episode when it airs. Thank you, guys.
Thank you.